Chapter 15. For instance, here are before us a few specimens. Do not, madam, be alarmed. You can skip the sentence if you like. To be found in as many admirable witty tales by the before lauded Monsieur de Bernard. He is more remarkable than any other French author, to our notion, for writing like a gentleman. There is ease, grace and ton in his style, which, if we judge aright, cannot be discovered in Balzac, or Sully, or Dumas. We have then Erfot, a novel. A lovely creature is married to a brave, haughty, Alsatian nobleman, who allows her to spend her winters at Paris, he remaining on his terres, cultivating, carousing, and hunting the boar. The lovely creature meets the fascinating Gerfot at Paris. Instantly the latter makes love to her. A duel takes place. Baron killed. Wife throws herself out of window. Gerfot plunges into dissipation. And so the tale ends. Next : La Femme de Quarantans, a capital tale, full of exquisite fun and sparkling satire. La Femme de Quarantans has a husband and three lovers, all of whom find out their mutual connection one starry night, for the lady of 40 is of a romantic poetical turn, and has given her three admirers a star apiece, saying to one and the other, Alphonse, when yon pale orb rises in heaven, think of me. Isidore, when that bright planet sparkles in the sky, remember your Caroline, and see, an act of virtue, from which we have taken D'Ambergiac's history, contains him, the husband, a wife and a brace of lovers, and a great deal of fun takes place in the manner in which one lover supplants the other. Pretty morals truly. If we examine an author who rejoices in the aristocratic name of Le Comte Horace de Ville Castle, we find, though with infinitely less wit, exactly the same intrigues going on. A noble count lives in the Faubourg Saint-Honoré, and has a noble duchess for a mistress. He introduces her grace to the countess, his wife. The countess, his wife, in order to remunerate her lord to his conjugal duties, is counseled, by a friend, to pretend to take a lover. One is found, who, poor fellow, takes the affair in earnest. Climax: duel, death, despair, and what not. In the Auberg Saint Germain, another novel by the same writer, which professes to describe the very pink of that society which Napoleon dreaded more than Russia, Prussia, and Austria, there is an old husband, of course, a sentimental young German nobleman, who falls in love with his wife. And the moral of the piece lies in the showing up of the conduct of the lady, who is reprehended not for deceiving her husband, poor devil, but for being a flirt, and taking a second lover, to the utter despair, confusion, and annihilation of the first. Why, ye gods, do Frenchmen marry at all? Had Pierre Infantin, who, it is said, has shaved his ambrosial beard, and is now a clerk in a banking house, been allowed to carry out his chaste, just, dignified social scheme, what a deal of marital discomfort might have been avoided. Would it not be advisable that a great reformer and lawgiver of our own, Mr. Robert Owen, should be presented at the Tuileries, and there propound his scheme for the regeneration of France? He might, perhaps, be spared, for our country is not yet sufficiently advanced to give such a philosopher fair play. In London, as yet, there are no blessed bureaux de mariage, where an old bachelor may have a charming young maiden for his money, or a widow of 70 may buy a gay young fellow of 20, for a certain number of bank billets. If marriages de convenance take place here as they will wherever avarice, and poverty, and desire, and yearning after riches are to be found, at least, thank God, such unions are not arranged upon a regular organized system. There is a fiction of attachment with us, and there is a consolation in the deceit, the homage, according to the old motto of Rochefoucauld, called, hitch vice pays to virtue. For the very falsehood shows that the virtue exists somewhere. We once heard a furious old French colonel inveighing against the chastity of English demoiselles : figures vows. Sir, said he had been a prisoner in England, that these women come down to dinner in low dresses, and walk out alone with the men. And, pray heaven, so may they walk, fancy free in all sorts of maiden meditations, and suffer no more molestation than that young lady of whom Moore sings, and who there must have been a famous Lord Lieutenant in those days, walked through all Ireland, with rich and rare gems, beauty, and a gold ring on her stick, without meeting or thinking of harm. Now, whether Monsieur de Villecastle has given a true picture of the Faubourg Saint Germain, it is impossible for most foreigners to say, but some of his descriptions will not fail to astonish the English reader, and all are filled with that remarkable naïf contempt of the institution called marriage, which we have seen in M. de Bernard. The romantic young nobleman of Westphalia arrives at Paris, and is admitted into what a celebrated female author calls la creme de la haute volée of Parisian society. He is a youth of about 20 years of age. Oh, passion had as yet come to move his heart, and give life to his faculties. He was awaiting and fearing the moment of love, calling for it, and yet trembling at its approach. Feeling in the depths of his soul that that moment would create a mighty change in his being, and decide, perhaps, by its influence, the whole of his future life. Is it not remarkable that a young nobleman, with these ideas, should not pitch upon a demoiselle, or a widow, at least, but no, the rogue must have a married woman, bad luck to him. And what his fate is to be, is thus recounted by our author, in the shape of a French fashionable conversation. A lady, with a great deal of esprit, to whom 40 years' experience of the great world had given a prodigious perspicacity of judgment, the Duchess of Chalux, arbitress of the opinion, to be held on all newcomers to the Faubourg Saint Germain, and of their destiny and reception in it. One of those women, in a word, who make or ruin a man, said, in speaking of Gerard de Stolberg, whom she received at her own house, and met everywhere, this young German will never gain for himself the title of an exquisite, or a man of bonds fortunes, among us. In spite of his calm and politeness, I think I can see in his character some rude and insurmountable difficulties, which time will only increase, and which will prevent him forever from bending to the exigencies of either profession. But, unless I very much deceive myself, he will, one day, be the hero of a veritable romance. ?" answered a young man, of fair complexion and fair hair, one of the most devoted slaves of the fashion. He, Madame la Duchesse? Why, the man is, at best, but an original, fished out of the Rhine. A dull, heavy creature, as much capable of understanding a woman's heart as I am of speaking Bas-Breton. Well, Monsieur de Belport, you will speak Bas-Breton. Monsieur de Stolberg has not your admirable ease of manner, nor your facility of telling pretty nothings, nor your, in a word, that particular something which makes you the most recherche man of the Faubourg Saint Germain. And even I avow to you that, were I still young, and a coquette, and that I took it into my head to have a lover, I would prefer you. All this was said by the Duchess, with a certain air of raillery, and such a mixture of earnest and malice, that Monsieur de Belport, piqued not a little, could not help saying, as he bowed profoundly before the Duchess's chair, "And might I, madam, be permitted to ask the reason of this preference?" Said the Duchess, always in the same tone, "because a lover like you would never think of carrying his attachment to the height of passion, and these passions, do you know, have frightened me all my life. One cannot retreat at will from the grasp of a passionate lover. One leaves behind one some fragment of one's moral self, or the best part of one's physical life. A passion, if it does not kill you, adds cruelly to your years. In a word, it is the very lowest possible taste. And now you understand why I should prefer you, M. de Belport, you who are reputed to be the leader of the fashion." ... murmured the gentleman, piqued more and more. "Gerard de Stolberg will be passionate. I don't know what woman will please him, or will be pleased by him. Here the Duchess of Chalux spoke more gravely, but his love will be no play, I repeat it to you once more. All this astonishes you, because you, great leaders of the ton that you are, never fancy that a hero of romance should be found among your number. Gerard de Stolberg, but, look, here he comes. M. de Belport rose, and quitted the Duchess, without believing in her prophecy, but he could not avoid smiling as he passed near the hero of romance. It was because M. de Stolberg had never, in all his life, been a hero of romance, or even an apprentice hero of romance. Gerard de Stolberg was not, as yet, initiated into the thousand secrets in the chronicle of the great world. He knew but superficially the society in which he lived, and, therefore, he devoted his evening to the gathering of all the information which he could acquire from the indiscreet conversations of the people about him. His whole man became mere and memory. So much was Stolberg convinced of the necessity of becoming a diligent student in this new school, where was taught the art of knowing and advancing in the great world. In the recess of a window he learned more on this one night than months of investigation would have taught him. The talk of a ball is more indiscreet than the confidential chatter of a company of idle women. No man present at a ball, whether listener or speaker, thinks he has a right to affect any indulgence for his companions, and the most learned in malice will always pass for the most witty. How? Said the Viscount de Mondrich. The Duchess of Rivesalt arrives alone tonight, without her inevitable Dormilly. And the Viscount, as he spoke, pointed towards a tall and slender young woman, who, gliding rather than walking, met the ladies by whom she passed, with a graceful and modest salute, and replied to the looks of the men by brilliant veiled glances full of coquetry and attack. Parbleu! Said an elegant personage standing near the Viscount de Mondrich, don't you see Dormilly ranged behind the Duchess, in quality of train bearer, and hiding, under his long locks and his great screen of mustaches, the blushing consciousness of his good luck? They call him the fourth chapter of the Duchess's memoirs. The little Marquise d'Albiras is ready to die out of spite. But the best of the joke is, that as he has only taken poor de Vendor for a lover in order to vent her spleen on him. Look at him against the chimney yonder. If the Marchioness do not break at once with him, by quitting him for somebody else, the poor fellow will turn an idiot. Is he jealous? Asked a young man, looking as if he did not know what jealousy was, and as if he had no time to be jealous. Jealous, the very incarnation of jealousy, the second edition, revised, corrected, and considerably enlarged. As jealous as poor Grisigny, who is dying of it. What? Grisigny too? Why, 'tis growing quite into fashion. Egad. I must try and be jealous, said Monsieur de Beauville. But see. Here comes the delicious Duchess of Belfier, and see. Enough, enough. This kind of fashionable Parisian conversation, which is, says our author, a prodigious labor of improvising, a chef d'oeuvre, a strange and singular thing, in which monotony is unknown, seems to be, if correctly reported, a strange and singular thing indeed, but somewhat monotonous at least to an English reader, and prodigious only, if we may take leave to say so, for the wonderful rascality which all the conversationists betray. Miss Neverout and the Colonel, in Swift's famous dialogue, are a thousand times more entertaining and moral, and, besides, we can laugh at those worthies as well as with them, whereas the prodigious French wits are to us quite incomprehensible. Fancy a duchess as old as Lady herself, and who should begin to tell us f what she would do, if ever s he had a mind to take a lover, and another duchess, with a fourth lover, tripping modestly among the ladies, and returning the gaze of the men by veiled glances, full of coquetry and attack. Parbleu, if Monsieur de Villecastel should find himself among a society of French duchesses, and they should tear his eyes out, and send the fashionable Orpheus floating by the Seine, his slaughter might almost be considered as justifiable counticide. A gambler's death. Anybody who was at sea school some 12 years since must recollect Jack Atwood. He was the most dashing lad in the place, with more money in his pocket than belonged to the whole fifth form in which we were companions. When he was about 15, Jack suddenly retreated from sea, and presently we heard that he had a commission in a cavalry regiment, and was to have a great fortune from his father when that old gentleman should die. Jack himself came to confirm these stories a few months after, and paid a visit to his old school chums. He had laid aside his little school jacket and inky corduroys, and now appeared in such a splendid military suit as won the respect of all of us. His hair was dripping with oil, his hands were covered with rings, he had a dusky down over his upper lip which looked not unlike a mustache, and a multiplicity of frogs and braiding on his surtout which would have sufficed to lace a field marshal. When old Swishtail, the usher, passed in his seedy black coat and gaiters, Jack gave him such a look of contempt as set us all a-laughing. In fact, it was his turn to laugh now, for he used to roar very stoutly some months before, when Swishtail was in the custom of belaboring him with his great cane. Jack's talk was all about the regiment, and the fine fellows in it. How he had ridden a steeplechase with Captain Boldero, and licked him at the last hedge, and how he had very nearly fought a duel with Sir George Grigg, about dancing with Lady Mary Slamkin at a ball. Soon made the baronet know what it was to deal with a man of the NTH, said Jack. Ami, sir, when I lugged out my barkers, and talked of fighting across the messroom table, Grigg turned as pale as a sheet, or as you used to do, Atwood, when Swishtail hauled you up, piped out little Hicks, the foundation boy. It was beneath Jack's dignity to thrash anybody now, but a grown-up baronet. So he let off little Hicks, and passed over the general titter which was raised at his expense. However, he entertained us with his histories about lords and ladies, and so f hours, until we thought him one of the greatest men in His Majesty's service, and until the school bell rung, when, with a heavy heart, we got our books together, and marched in to be whacked by old Swishtail. I promise you he revenged himself on us for Jack's contempt of him. I got that day at least 20 cuts to my share, which ought to have belonged to Cornet Atwood, of the NTH Dragoons. When we came to think more coolly over our quondam schoolfellow's swaggering talk and manner, we were not quite so impressed by his merits as at his first appearance among us. We recollected how he used, in former times, to tell us great stories, which were so monstrously improbable, that the smallest boy in the school would scout them, how often we caught him tripping in facts, and how unblushingly he admitted his little errors in the score of veracity. He and I, though never great friends, had been close companions. I was Jack's form fellow. We fought with amazing emulation for the last place in the class, but still I was rather hurt at the coolness of my old comrade, who had forgotten all our former intimacy, in his steeplechases with Captain Boldero, and his duel with Sir George Grigg. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.